We are building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh. 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 Ooh.
Welcome, friends, to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Michael Negler. Today's Friday, February 5th, 2016, and we will be exploring the power of active nonviolence and really what comes underneath of that, which is our capacity to help others to transform, help ourselves to transform in ways that really get the job done in a way that violence really can't. And the theme of the show today is the question of humiliation. So as we go through the show, and we're going to start off with a little bit of nonviolence in the news because there's a lot going on. And once we, you know, get past all of the humiliation activities that seem like they're nonviolent activities, you know, interpretations of political events and so forth, that instead of offering critique, offer humiliation, so forth. When we get underneath of that, there's actually a lot going on. Very, very creative work. So, Michael, why don't you bring us in with a little bit of nonviolence in the news before we have our big conversation?
Stephanie, I'd be delighted. Thanks. Yes, and as you say, there is a lot going on, and much of it is not humiliating, at least the part that I'm going to report on. I'd like to mention, again, a resource that I just touched on last time, which is a website called humanmedia.org, especially humanmedia.org/nonviolence. It features stories of peacemakers who help to break the cycle of brutality, and they have a big motto up on their homepage, which is the power of nonviolence. So this is a really welcome resource that's available for us on the web. Another one that I've also mentioned before, but I want to bring us a little bit up to speed, is Campaign Nonviolence. As you may be aware, that they are going to launch another, I think the third annual week in the middle of September of nonviolent actions, and you can start an action in your community and sign up. They actually have six activities going on, which kind of sounds like a smaller version of the Meta Center. You know, it's funny, they're much bigger than we are, and they're trying to do much less. But anyway, one is this taking nonviolent action. Second is called fostering a nonviolent culture, and under that category there, activity is called nonviolent cities. They want cities to declare that they are nonviolent, which can be done. Very important, they're expanding nonviolence training. They want to put on 1,000 trainings. I'll have something to say about that in just a second. They're nurturing a movement of movements. They're spreading resources for peaceful change, and they're building their own organization, Campaign Nonviolence. Now, about that training, I just want to mention that, as I reported recently, Nonviolent Peace Force is going to be mounting a very large project in South Sudan aimed at preventing gender-based violence, which is very common in that area. And the Meta Center may be working with them to include a component that used to be called interpretation. Interpretation means getting the word out in a way that the general public can understand it, which is exactly what we're doing here on Peace Paradigm Radio. But possibly to be able to do this on a bigger scale so that the incredible stories of courage and hope that NP and other groups that are doing unarmed civilian peace keeping turn up, that they'll be able to turn those stories into mainstream media. So this kind of bridges the gap between resources and the news section of our news report, and that is that in the week that was dedicated to celebrating the 68th anniversary of the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi, which was on January 31st, several groups coordinated in Mumbai with the Bombay Sarvodaya Mandal. Actually, they're still calling themselves Bombay Sarvodaya Mandal, though their city has gone back to the name of Mumbai. They sold 2.5 lakhs, that's 250,000 rupees worth of books on Gandhi and Vinoba in 1 week. That's almost $40,000. Wish I had been there. An anecdote from Tim DeChristopher, whose organization is called the Climate Disobedience Center, an excellent name for an excellent group. His famous action was in 2008 when he stood up and offered to purchase at an auction a large tract that the government was auctioning off to individual private interests, which would have been exploitive. He bid so much money that he won. Of course, it turned out that he didn't have a dime, and he spent 18 months in federal prison. But there was another trial recently, which was a lobster boat blockade that was preventing the delivery of coal to a power plant. They said that they were, quote, very confrontational, but very inviting, which is an interesting combination from the nonviolence point of view. You're not against the person, but by golly, you're not going to accept what they're doing. We'll have to talk about that when we finally get around to our humiliation and dignity talk. But anyway, the reason this is worth mentioning is that the district attorney took charge of the trial, dismissed all the charges, and then came out of the courtroom and gave the activists a rousing speech about how they were helping children and their children's children from climate disruption. So that is a wonderful result of a nonviolent campaign. The fact that they were inviting while they were being confrontational. In other words, in nonviolence, you're always inviting your opponent to join you. The assumption always is that the opponent can join you. And that's why you're never against the opponent as a person. You're aiming at what that person or persons are doing. So we have another similar protest that went on at the White House. This one did not have anyone march out and tell them you're doing the right thing. But it was to kick off a nationwide Days of Action, which are against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the TPP. And I'll read you a quote. In front of the White House today, this was last week, people representing the Alliance for Democracy, the American Medical Students Association, it's an interesting one, a group called Beyond Extreme Energy, Friends of the Earth, and Popular Resistance, who report this news, and Veterans for Peace and more spoke out against the TPP to launch the Days of Action to get that thing stopped. We've reported on that before when we had Kevin and Margaret on the show. Related, but rather different in focus, there is now a push to have a universal declaration of farmers' rights, and that would especially include seed saving. This must make Vandana Shiva very happy because she has been fighting the practices of genetically modifying seeds and entrapping farmers in a desperate cycle where their seed doesn't regenerate, and that has actually caused an appalling number of Indian farmers to commit suicide. So here in this hemisphere, Via Campesina was formed in 1983. 1 year after MetaCenter, a famous year, 1983. When a group of peasants united to form a stronger voice and strategize on the issues that they were suffering from. In the course of time, Via Campesina has become a global movement to advocate for policies which really meet the needs of the poor and the marginalized. They develop global actions on agroecology, That is the alternative to agribusiness on biodiversity, seeds, land and water, stopping transnational corporations, and so on and so forth. As I've mentioned before, I think this is very important because this is a brand new voice in the movement. It reminds me of how in toward the end of Gandhi's campaign in South Africa, this was 1912-1913, suddenly two new voices were heard. The voices of the women, because a British judge had declared that only Christian marriages were legal and valid, and therefore suddenly all of these Hindu wives were illegitimate. That was a deep, deep shock to their personal dignity and to their sense of religion. This is where the British constantly were getting it wrong. They failed always to understand how important religion and religious values were to Hindus and Muslims alike in India. Anyway, suddenly women were brought in, and this was new in history that, I mean, unless you go back to the Amazons and Boadicea, that women actually played a significant and conscious role in a social struggle. Of course, the suffragettes were also happening at that time, but they were not entirely a nonviolent enterprise. So the women came in, and also the indentured laborers. Gandhi had been speaking on their behalf, but they had not been speaking themselves, and they were brought in as a result of a miner strike in the Transvaal. So having those two new dimensions made a tremendous difference in the power of the movement, not just in terms of numbers, but in terms of their universality. And so we have a very hopeful and promising example of this with Via Campesina. It's the first time that indigenous people have been able to unite without losing their individual diversity of their ways, and they're enabled to unite around issues that affect all of them and bring their voice into the global discourse, which is a wonderful thing. End of January, we lost a personality in the peace movement. Her name was Concepcion Picciotto. She was born in Spain, and she had for 35 years held up protest signs every day in Lafayette Square across from the White House. My friend, former peace journalist Coleman McCarthy, now peace educator, writes a beautiful obituary of hers and points out that five successive presidents, from Ronald Reagan to Obama, saw Connie outside their window in the West Wing. No one ever went out to talk to her. No one, needless to say, no one ever invited her into the White House. So it really makes you wonder. You know, I cannot believe that her effort was in vain. I have to believe that it's an example of one of these things in nonviolence that operates under the surface. And as one British essayist said, she is carrying on her conversation with the future. She's telling on the conscience of the nation, even though you don't see exactly how. Similarly, a doctor, Dr. Jeff Hood, who has really acquired a strong passion to get rid of the death penalty, has taken to walking across the country and walked hundreds of miles. And he says, truthfully, all my journeys have led to moments where I wondered if I was doing anything productive. But in those hours of struggle, the words of an old nun that she had whispered into his ear came back to him. Presence is the antidote to killing. Again, another one of those symbolic actions which don't have an immediate visible effect, but we have to believe they are telling on the social forces. I'm going to skip some items here, Stephanie, so we can get to our conversation. But I do want to mention that 5 years after the successful revolution in Tunisia, which launched Arab Spring, Again, we're seeing one of these situations where that movement which got rid of Ben Ali, a rather authoritarian president, has not been able to carry through and lead to the necessary reforms in employment and other features of Tunisian social life. 800,000 people in that small country are without work. So protests are starting to break out all over the country again. It's time to act, says one young person, or nothing will prevent the outbreak of a second revolution. And this was said on December 17th, the anniversary of the beginning. In future broadcasts, I hope to give you some reports about what's going on in Okinawa, which is like Jeju but more successful. And I'd just like to close.
No need to close. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and this news is a little bit different than other news you might get elsewhere because it's all about nonviolence in action all over the world. So, Michael, please do continue. Let's give you a good chance to get your news up because we usually rush you through it. So it's your news right now.
Thank you, Stephanie. I was getting close to the end. I was saying that I want to report more about Okinawa, but also on the events side of the story. In February 22nd, this month, on the 27th, there's going to be a large demonstration in London, and the issue there is to get rid of the Trident submarine. This would significantly advance the cause of outgrowing what they call the madness of militarism. And it would send an ideal message to the United States, which has been electing leaders who voice the popular demand to abolish nukes on the one hand, but then go and invest over, get this, $1 trillion in making nuclear weapons more, quote, usable, unquote. In April, looking down the road, in Oakland, the East Point Peace Academy is going to be putting on a couple of events, workshops, on Kingian nonviolence. And as the time gets closer, I'll be saying more about that, but you can look up eastpointpeace.org to get more on that. The Fellowship of Reconciliation has put on a program called, or is putting on a program this month, a TV program called Understanding Socialism. That is timely because the front-running Democratic candidate for President of the United States, as we speak, is a declared socialist. I don't know if he declares, Bernie declares that he's a socialist, but other people think he is. And so this will be on TCTV Channel 22, and it's going to air three times a week during February, every Monday at 1:30, every Wednesday at 5 p.m., and every Thursday at 9, Understanding Socialism by the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Finally, I'd like to offer an editorial observation. There was a somewhat poignant article this week in Tom Dispatch. It was also posted in Popular Resistance because it's the anniversary that's recently passed of the big demonstrations in 2003 that were attempts to preempt the Iraq War. As you maybe remember, it was the largest popular outpouring of that kind in history. Something like 11 or 12 million people around the world were expressing their total disapproval of President Bush's war plans. And he, the president, said, I don't have to pay attention to these people. This is just a focus group. Now, my point with that has always been that he was signaling the fact that he's in what we call phase two of the conflict escalation curve, the phase where you can no longer get anywhere by arguments and by appealing to the head. As Gandhi said, you have to appeal to the heart. You have to move people at a deeper level, and that has to be done with deeper commitment, which often involves a certain kind of self-suffering, ultimately perhaps of a certain kind of self-sacrifice. And because we were the protesters were unprepared to do that. They had not prepared that in advance. They were stumped at a stage which was no longer active. So Tom Engelhardt writes the following, and this is what I want to comment on. Of course, this vast upsurge of global opposition would prove to be right on the mark. While all the brilliant policymakers and pundits in Washington were desperately wrong. And yet the invasion did happen, and in its wake, we, not they, were wiped out of history. None of us would be consulted when the retrospectives began. No one would want to hear from those who had been right about the invasion, only officials and, quote, experts who had been dismally wrong. So in the process, as he concludes, that pre-war movement of ours would essentially be erased from history. And I want us to think why. There are two reasons that come up for me. One is actually embedded in the other. The first reason is that we tend to trust people who are in positions of recognizable authority and not people who represent the voice of a discontented minority, even if that minority grows pretty big. So we trust people who wear three-piece suits and sit around oaken tables in Washington, but not millions of people who are marching down the streets in Manhattan and their colleagues all around the world. But there's a deeper reason for this, and it's something that we at the Metter Center have been working on a lot. And I guess the way I would put it is we kind of don't have a syntax in our logical structure. We don't have a framework in our minds to understand where the protesters are coming from and what they are proposing. We are, and we speaking very generally here, including many of us who consider ourselves progressives, fall back on the belief that the old story is correct, and that's a story which says that we are separate from one another, that we must, in the end, fall back on abusive force in order to get things done. So when there's a threat like ISIS, and God knows they are a threat, we feel that we have to use abusive force against them. That's the only thing that will really stop them. So we don't pay attention to people who are saying, don't use abusive force, because then we fear we'll be left without recourse. Now think now about this French journalist, Nicolas Hena, who was a hostage of ISIS for 10 months. His cellmates were beheaded. He does not hold a brief for ISIS. He's totally against these people. But he knows them. And he said, from his vantage point, what we're doing is exactly wrong. They want us to bomb them because that proves to them that their apocalyptic definition of their role in history is correct. They want to be attacked because otherwise they don't have a platform to go from. And I want to bring in here, by way of transition, Steph, to the rest of our program today, a very astute commentator who summed up in two words what is motivating these extremists, and that is that they are, quote, enraged and humiliated. Mm-hmm. And thank you. That wraps up my news report and analysis for this edition of Peace Paradigm Radio.
Thank you very much, Michael. And I love the way that you were able to incorporate some ideas of the image of the human being and the image of conflict resolution, what we call really the new story, that really we need to grasp and wrap our minds around in order to make sense of not only the news that you're talking about, but making sense of moving forward, if you will, in terms of resolving some longstanding challenges that we're facing and that drive people into forms of activism or frustration or even totalitarianism in other times. So But before we get to our conversation then about the aspect of humiliation and how it's playing out, how it seems to be playing out right now in our politics, but also in our daily lives and how we participate in that and what that has to do with nonviolence, let's talk a little bit about nonviolence for those who are just tuning in, maybe haven't heard the show before, or who are questioning what that means, because many people would say that humiliation can be a form of nonviolent resistance because you're not shooting somebody, you're not using a weapon, you're using humiliation. So that's not the same as using violence. So before we get into that, let's talk about what nonviolence is. And we have a definition at the Meta Center for Nonviolence where we say that we think about nonviolence a lot. And we think that it's more than just a tactic or a technique where a large group of people is able to overthrow a dictator. We understand nonviolence as something that we can practice in our individual lives and in our social lives and our collective spheres. And even, institution building and so forth. And we say that nonviolence is the conversion of a negative drive within the human being, like fear or greed or anger, into its positive counterpart. And so when we're able to feel what rises within us, in this situation, I might feel a lot of fear and or anger. And then I say, okay, I'm feeling the anger, but I don't want to then act out of the anger in a way that expresses violence. So what I can do is I can use that energy as a tool, as a form of energy to go down another channel where I use it to fuel action that helps to bring me closer to a more noble goal. The same goal that I probably have, and if I were to choose to use violence, it would bring me actually closer to the goal that I have, and it would bring the parties who are involved also closer together. Michael, do you have something you'd like to add to that definition?
You bet I do, Stephanie. Surprise, surprise. Two things, actually. One is the implication of what you're saying, and there's good scientific evidence for this now, is that those destructive drives like fear, anger, greed are not primordial. They are something that has happened to a basic energy. So in a sense, we're just putting it back into its original form. And if that were not important enough, the other thing I wanted to point out is that notice that in that scenario that you just described, right, you have not surrendered your agency. Mm-hmm. So, and this is critical. If a person threatens me and I respond to that person's program, I have no agency. I'm letting him call my emotional shots. Mm-hmm. But if once a person has presented me with a threat of some kind, and I decide that I can do different things with that threat, I have not surrendered my agency. I am still a free person, able to choose my response. And that's a tremendous feature of nonviolent response, which is very different from violent response. They attack us, we have to attack them back.
Mm-hmm. And people have seen nonviolence, the word nonviolence, used all over, I'm sure, but maybe never going deep into the issue that we have the opportunity to go into in the show and then in our work with the Meta Center. So some people see it spelled non-violence. Some people see nonviolence as one word. And usually the image that flashes before their mind is, weakness, soft. Gandhi was a moral person. And this is a religious thing. And that's not the way that we understand it. First of all, the non-violence, it means simply that, you've refrained from the physical violence. So there's that kind of definition. Then you have non-violence as one word, which we use at Meta, which is more in terms of the translations of ahimsa and satyagraha that Gandhi helped to develop, which he saw them really as experiments in truth and very scientific ways of exploring that great human nature that we have. For those who are just tuning in, you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and you just heard Nonviolence in the News from Michael Nagler, who is my co-host. I'm Stephanie Van Hook. And now let's turn to the conversation that we were wanting to have with our listeners and then supporters today, which is about humiliation. What is it? How do we participate in it? And how is it coming to define politics and even sometimes nonviolent action in our world? And what can we do about that? So, Michael, would you like to get us started off with a story about Mahatma Gandhi and humiliation?
Yes, I'd be happy to. There is a famous story about a man who writes to him. You know, he was kind of the Dear Abby of nonviolence. And someone wrote to him and said, there's this bully in our community, and he slapped me, and I felt humiliated, and I didn't do anything. And now, aren't you proud of me? And Gandhi said, no, you should have slapped him back. But he added to that, why did you feel humiliated? This is extremely important. It was his problem, not yours. And that reminds me of another statement that he frequently made in his newspapers, where people would write him some kind of a stinging letter. He would quote it. He would print it in full. He didn't try to hide it. And he would start off his reply very often by saying, this comment appears to be offered as an insult. Mm-hmm. However, I choose not to take it as such. Mm-hmm. And then he would simply launch into developing his counter-argument. So it's a lot like what we were just saying before, Stephanie, that no one can really deprive you of your agency. You have to give it to them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That said, that very interesting story spoken. Why did Gandhi say, you know, you should have hit him back? First of all, what does that have to do with nonviolence and the relationship to humiliation?
Okay, now we're getting to the hard stuff. Mm-hmm. trust you to push further.
Okay.
Because he felt that anything was better than cowardice. Anything was better than weakness. You know, as he frequently said, I can make a satyagrahi, a nonviolent person, out of a violent person. I cannot make a satyagrahi out of a coward. So I'm pretty sure that that's what he was thinking of here. That if you fail to strike back because you were afraid you'd get hit harder, that the bully was stronger than you were, then you are acting out of cowardice, not out of your ability to rise above, to not accept the humiliation that was being offered to you. What do you think?
Well, okay, if you really take that in, okay, when somebody offers you humiliation and to not accept it, okay, that's one thing. And it sounds actually like everything in nonviolence, that sounds like a very difficult thing to ask of people.
Of course.
And so the thing that I would say is that when we're trying to learn how to deepen our nonviolence skills, so this is, it's for somebody who says, you know, I want to deepen my nonviolence. I want to practice this on a regular basis, and you cannot practice nonviolence without coming across the topic of how do you respond on the one hand to humiliation when you receive it. What's the danger of responding to humiliation, of feeling humiliated? What is the danger? The danger is that we put people in power that then speak to our dignity in ways that could be very, very violent. So, Michael, I know that you read some literature about the rise of Hitler to power, for example, and it was based on this notion that the German people had been humiliated. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I actually had this experience. I was a student in Germany in the late 60s, and there was a program that the university was putting on called Studenten aller Welt singen und tanzen für Heidelberg, which means students from all the world singing and dancing for Heidelberg. And it was fun. It was great. The French students put on this kind of 17th century, highly costumed dance performance, which was, you know, quite delightful and quite French. And the Germans did whatever they did. I don't quite remember what they did, but there was a French student sitting in front of me who shouted out, "Vive les barbares allemands!" Long live the German barbarians, which he probably, now maybe not, but he probably meant that as a compliment. Anyway, he was some kind of approving of them. I mean, he was sitting in Germany, after all. It was only about 15 years after the conclusion of the war. But to my mind, that brought up the whole reason for Hitler's rise to power and World War II. He offered the German people a sense of dignity. I will have to add, a false sense of dignity, because you never can establish your dignity on the crushing of another person. But there had been this long tradition in Europe of looking upon the Germans as somewhat backward in a way that matters a very great deal to Europeans. And so they felt humiliated, and then, of course, the military losses in 1878 and in 1916 through 18 were just adding to that sense of humiliation. And I remember reading just before the war broke out, there was a representative of the Nazi Party in Paris, and a Parisian said to him, "Well, I hope you're aware that the word Nazi in Parisian discourse these days means, dopey, terrible, unfashionable." And this German said to him, "Tant pis, you know, so much the worse. So much the worse for you guys," because he knew at the back of his mind that that usage was only adding to the fury with which they were bound to respond.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and this is a program where we discuss nonviolence and try to get into the deeper angles of why people would go down a route of violence or nonviolence. And the humiliation, when we don't talk about it in our society, we can miss a really big part about what is currently happening in our politics, in the way that children are, running into certain troubles, so forth. So, and how we view what nonviolence is, because if nonviolence is understood as weak, which it isn't. It's very, very, it's difficult, and for anybody who decides to go down this path, it's a long journey ahead and a lot of work. Now, the problem is that how do we understand our own participation in the way that humiliation is spread? So now let's turn to looking at the way we work with children, for example. What does humiliation mean when, if you have to help a child to understand that they have erred in some way without using humiliation? So how do we define what humiliation is, and how can we see it in practice? Because, for example, I saw something that, as I was doing a little bit of research about the topic, where these parents actually had to go to jail for this. But they had their 12-year-old put on a diaper, and they shaved her head and had her run around the yard outside of her house because she wasn't getting good grades in school. So, I mean, that is these, and the parents, you know, they went to jail for this. So, but that's humiliation.
Really?
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's overt humiliation. But there's also subtle humiliations and shamings that take place when somebody who considers themselves, you know, in more power than you have, shames you and makes you feel less than a person. That, too, is humiliation. So understanding that how this is working and where it's working is affecting the way that children are growing up. Can you say something about that?
You know, Gandhi actually was not above using shame. Now, there's a subtle difference here, but I think it's quite definable, and it does help to understand the issue that you're raising there. He often made the British ashamed that they were, for example, shaking their the lion's bloody claws in the people's face. The difference, I believe, is this, that in shame, you're talking about what a person has done. In humiliation, you're talking about what they are.
Okay. All right. So the parents who did this to their child, having them go to prison was a form of shaming them in a way for what they've done. And yet we know that the prison system isn't working. So can we really make the case that shame does that same kind of work? So I think that what you're looking for is probably not the idea of shame, is it?
I'm not sure I know what to say about that. Because the one piece that I feel pretty secure about is the difference between what you've done and what you are. And this is why not subjecting anyone to humiliation was one of the most powerful tools that Gandhi came up with. Because he knew instinctively, intuitively, that if you deprecate, if you downgrade another person's dignity, you've downgraded human dignity, and that you yourself participate in that. And you might remember James Baldwin saying, "It is a mysterious fact that no one can denigrate another person without bringing himself down." So there must be a way to resolve disputes without adding to the degradation of humanity and suffering in that yourself.
I want to get into that, and I also want to point out that research has shown that one of the number one, you know, the top indicators for violence in adults has been humiliation in childhood. So again, humiliation is extremely serious, and we might not even be aware when we are inflicting humiliation on another. How do we become aware of it?
Boy, I don't know if I have a direct answer to that question. It's so tempting to humiliate another person. But the research that you were referring to, I actually wanted to talk about for a second, Stephanie. It was done by a psychiatrist, James Gilligan, who was a forensic psychiatrist and spent 25 years in the Massachusetts prison system studying people who were serial killers. That people of that whose violence was that extreme, and he on one occasion he went around asking them, "What do you want so badly that you would sacrifice anything to get it?" And one of the inmates declared, "Pride, dignity, self-esteem." And he went on to say, and he used a word that I am not going to repeat here on the radio. He said, "I'll kill every blankety blank in this cell block if I have to in order to get it." And another one said, "I've got to have my self-respect, and I've declared war on the whole world until I get it." So what we're seeing here is people whose response cannot be faulted. If they've been, as they say, dissed, they've been disrespected, particularly in their youth. And I really cringe thinking about that 12-year-old girl, because that's like one of the most sensitive periods in our life to dignity and the lack of dignity. I cringe thinking about that. But we have to ask ourselves, what is wrong with their response? The men in the who've murdered in order to get dignity. And what's wrong is that you cannot dignify yourself by inflicting indignity or suffering on another. It's this failure to recognize that we're all in this together, this false belief that you are so radically separate from another person that their suffering can add to your benefit, that is really the root of the problem.
Okay. And, you know, I want to keep going deeper into this because it's a big can of worms. Mm-hmm. So when we understand that, if we even grasp it or, you know, seem to think that that sounds like a good idea, that because it's not something necessarily that we see with our eyes, it's something that's felt, it's something that, you know, its repercussions are could be later, and we understand it, and it's realization that we're interconnected and that my good is interwoven with yours. So that said, and that's a part of things, there's another aspect of nonviolence where there's not one single person has all of the truth, okay? And that there's the big truth, which is, you know, the bedrock of our human nature, which is that we're fundamentally good at the basis, and that's not going to change. But it's the other stuff that gets in the way. We have to get back to that. But you know, truth, then the smaller t's look different. And some say that the challenge in nonviolence is to be able to understand how somebody arrived at their truth and to, you know, offer your truth as, at the same time, without backing away from yours, and, you know, letting truth do its work. Okay? So before I go on from there, Gandhi said that it's not nonviolence if you're only being nonviolent with people who agree with you or who are already nonviolent. Okay, so here we have, you know, you and I might have a disagreement, and you and I might both have this understanding of the bedrock of human nature. I'm holding one truth, you're holding another truth, and we have to work it out to try to see, you know, where we meet and where our truth meet. And he would say that's not being nonviolent. Nonviolence is what happens when you, when I'm able to offer nonviolence to someone who isn't feeling like their truth is even closely compatible with mine, and I'm still able to, you know, proceed and work together without getting in the way of my own curiosity of understanding their truth. Okay, and I think that thing that gets in the way of understanding somebody else's truth who we are vehemently in disagreement with is humiliation, because it's very tempting at that point, if someone disagrees with you politically, socially, to use humiliation as a way of persuading them, of trying to persuade them at least, to see your truth before you understand theirs. Okay, Michael.
That was so well said, Stephanie, and it brings me back to the same thing, that the violent response is to attack the person, whereas the nonviolent response is to empower the person so that they can step up to the truth and to come at them with the assumption that they can. It's reminding me, in fact, you reminded me a little earlier of that wonderful comment that Arnold Toynbee, the British historian, made, where he said that Gandhi made it impossible for us to go on ruling India, but he made it possible for us to leave without rancor and without humiliation.
Aha, there's the key word. Again, Toynbee looking back on history and saying that Gandhi helped to lead a movement that strove not to embrace the short-term gains that humiliation might achieve. Say more.
Short term is, again, really the key. I think that Gandhi did not believe that he had to do anything untrue for a strategic advantage. Now, there is kind of a gray area here. Sometimes you have to coerce people and you don't have time to persuade them. That's true. You got to get a dictator out of power, you get him out of power. But if you have your eye on the long term, then there really is no difference between the strategic thing to do and the true thing to do. So that he could offer people dignity, and incidentally, that's one of the terms for nonviolence in Tagalog, in the Philippine language. They called nonviolence, back in the people power movement, to offer dignity. Mm-hmm. You can offer them dignity because it's strategically helpful, but also because you think it's the long-term true thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now let's now step forward a little bit or move forward a teeny bit in terms of understanding our own participation in this process of humiliation, because a few friends and I have been conducting an experiment to watch for and observe the way that humiliation is taking place in specifically our political discourse and when we participate in it. So I feel like every time I go onto social media, there's a new person that I disagree with, but there's a new person who is being held up as the person to humiliate today. And even though I disagree with them, I realize, even if it's just laughing at their, having a really good laugh at their expense and making them seem even more ridiculous than they made themselves seem, it concerns me that it's happening, because it fuels this negativity about the human image. It fuels the negativity in our political discourse, and it's not very effective. It's not really doing that much, you know. And so I'm concerned about the way that we're missing the point of nonviolence, because it's so creative. There, we can offer really good critiques of somebody's ridiculous statements that totally undermine, you know, everything that they said in a way that can be creative, clear, and very useful. And yet we spend a lot of time and energy using, you know, just engaging in these little, you know, laughs, but that are really degrading the human image, which then are sending people who feel humiliated, because when they see their figure being humiliated, they feel like you're humiliating them too. So then it's sending people to then, you know, join along with that person, because that person then is offering them.
Representing them.
Yeah. So, and then this is, you know, when we ask the question, how did Hitler come into power? And because of way that humiliation works, the more we engage in it, the more we alienate ourselves from people that we really need to be connecting with.
And the way Hitler went out of power was to try to humiliate others, because he did more damage to human dignity than almost any human being living. What you were saying, another way you could look at that is people are sacrificing the future for the present. They're sacrificing long-term gain of the entire human community in order to gain something from a particular person. And again, it seems to me that what they're doing is trying to get rid of the person, not the idea.
And the challenge here, then, is it's dividing us more and more. And the greater the divisions, the less able we are to come together and really address the issues that need to get changed, because we need to be able to hear one another. So this is the experiment that my friends and I did, but just to note, to become aware of humiliation. And so when I go into social media now for the past few weeks, I've just been watching, do I click on something that has a headline that suggests the humiliation of some person? Do I go there? Do I share it? How am I spreading that? And I invite you, dear listeners, to think of the same. Then, you know, notice it in your environment, and notice it especially if you're using the social media. If you can boycott the humiliation discourse in favor of something else, and just see it as an experiment. What changes, and how do you change your perspective? Michael, any last thoughts?
Yes, one last thought, Stephanie, which is a compliment to what you just said. When I look at my own experience, what I do is I try to engage my empathy, and I know how much humiliation hurts me, and so I, as it were, feel the hurt of another person, and that prevents me from humiliating them.
Thank you very much, Michael. And so if anybody has any thoughts on the topic of today's show on humiliation and offering dignity and how that comes together for you, please do send us your comments and let us know. And you can do that by writing it to us at info@metacenter.org. This has been Peace Paradigm Radio. Thank you to our mother station, KWMR, to all of our listeners, to all of the volunteers and staff at the Meta Center. Until the next time, everyone take care of one another. Bye.